Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into the fascinating world of population, what it is, what makes it change, and, well, why it really matters to all of us. At its heart, a population is simply a group of the same species living in a defined geographic area. Pretty basic definition.
That sounds basic, yeah.
But don't let that fool you. We could be talking about a tiny, isolated community, you know, with really clear boundaries.
Or something much bigger.
Or a massive interconnected global population where the lines get pretty blurry.
Exactly. And understanding that variability is, I think, really key. Our mission today is to get under the skin of population dynamics.
Right.
We want to uncover the core forces that drive these population shifts, explore the often surprising consequences, and ultimately connect it all back to how we live.
How it affects society.
Yeah, think of it as decoding some of the biggest trends shaping our future, really.
And we've got some compelling insights lined up. We'll be navigating the factors that directly influence population size, everything from the ebb and flow of migration.
Which we'll get into.
To the fundamental dance of birth and death rates, and that crucial indicator, infant mortality.
Very important, yes.
Then we'll look at how populations are structured, you know, by age and gender, and what those structures tell us through dependency ratios.
And that leads into some interesting planning implications.
We'll even wrestle with that intriguing concept of an optimal population size. Is there such a thing?
Huh, that's a big question. We'll also be weighing the often unexpected pluses and minuses of population growth.
All right, the good and the bad.
Examining the various tools societies use to manage these changes, and then focusing on the profound implications and potential solutions for our increasingly aging populations.
Which is a huge topic globally now.
Absolutely. And finally, we'll explore how the movement of people within countries, internal migration, reshapes communities and economies. So yeah, a comprehensive journey.
Okay, sounds great. Let's dive right in then. What are the fundamental drivers? What makes a population expand or contract? Migration seems like the obvious starting point.
It is, yeah, but it has nuances.
Yeah.
We talk about immigration when people move into a region. That clearly adds to the population count.
Okay, immigration in.
Then we have emigration, which is when people leave. Naturally, that decreases the number.
Immigration out. Simple enough.
But what's really telling, the key metric, is the balance between these two movements.
Ah, so it's not just about the absolute numbers moving in or out on their own.
Precisely. That's where net migration comes into play. It's simply the number of immigrants minus the number of emigrants over a period.
Okay, the difference.
Yeah. A positive net migration means more people are arriving than departing, leading to population growth.
Makes sense.
Conversely, negative net migration means more are leaving than arriving, resulting in a shrinking population. It's that net effect that really shapes the overall trend.
That makes the picture much clearer, so it's the balance that counts. Now, another factor you mentioned, which seems incredibly important and quite sobering, is the infant mortality rate.
It is a deeply significant indicator, yes. It's defined as the number of babies who die before reaching their first birthday. For every 1,000 live births in a given year.
Per 1,000 live births. Okay.
And what's fascinating, well, maybe sobering is the right word, is how closely this rate is linked to the overall well-being of a society.
How so?
Generally, a lower infant mortality rate points to better healthcare access, improved nutrition, sanitation, overall healthier living conditions. It's a strong proxy for development.
Right.
And critically for our discussion, when more infants survive, that has a direct and significant impact on long-term population growth.
So fewer tragic infant deaths translate directly into more individuals while surviving and contributing to the population down the line.
Exactly. And then, of course, we have the absolute fundamentals, birth rates and death rates.
It's core duo.
Pretty much. High birth rates, meaning more babies being born relative to the existing population size, are a primary engine of population growth.
And what influences those?
Oh, a fascinating mix. Cultural norms around family size play a huge role. The level of education, particularly for women, is critical. And, of course, the availability and acceptance of reproductive health care and family planning.
That makes sense. And on the other side of the coin, a low death rate also fuels population increase. That feels like something often seen as a sign of progress, right?
Absolutely. Low death rates are typically a result of advancements in medicine, vaccines, antibiotics, better surgical procedures.
Huge changes over the last century or so.
Massive. Plus, better sanitation practices, improved nutrition, and just overall higher standards of living that allow people to live longer, healthier lives. Think about the impact of something as basic as access to clean water.
Game changer.
It really is. These factors have dramatically reduced mortality across all age groups and contributed hugely to population expansion globally.
Okay, so we've identified the main levers: migration balance, infant survival, births, and deaths. Now, let's dig into the why behind it all. Why do populations grow in the first place? And what explains the, frankly, huge differences in growth rates we see around the world?
Well, many of the underlying reasons circle back to those core factors we just discussed, but maybe with a bit more context. Improved healthcare is monumental.
We touched on that with death rates.
Exactly. It's led to that dramatic decline in deaths from infectious diseases, better management of chronic conditions, and just a significant increase in average life expectancy pretty much everywhere, though to varying degrees.
Right.
High birth rates, as we mentioned, are often connected to a limited access to contraception and family planning education. In some communities, large families might still be seen as a source of labor or economic security in old age or even social status.
It's almost hard to imagine from, say, a Western perspective sometimes, but a lack of education can really perpetuate those larger family sizes, can't it?
It really can. When individuals, especially women, lack information about family planning options, or maybe lack the agency to use them, or even lack awareness of the broader opportunities that smaller families might afford, well, larger families might just be the traditional or expected path.
Tradition is powerful.
Immensely. Cultural values exert a powerful influence. Some societies have long-standing traditions that favor large families or encourage early marriage and childbearing. And we can't overlook the role of certain religious beliefs, which in some cases may discourage or prohibit the use of contraception.
So, really deeply ingrained societal factors. And then, as we've already discussed, migration acts as another significant engine of growth, particularly in certain regions.
Absolutely. People are constantly on the move, seeking better economic prospects, fleeing conflict or persecution for greater personal safety, or simply pursuing a higher perceived quality of life across borders.
The push and pull factor.
Exactly. These migratory flows can significantly and sometimes very rapidly alter the population size and structure of both ascending and the receiving regions.
Okay, so those are the broad reasons for growth. Now, why the big differences between countries? Why does country A grow fast while country B grows slowly or even shrinks?
It really comes down to the interplay of these same factors, but how they manifest differently in different national contexts.
So variations in birth rates are obviously a primary driver. You mentioned access to family planning and education.
Precisely. Countries that have invested heavily in providing widespread, accessible family planning services and have achieved higher levels of education, again, particularly among women, tend to exhibit lower birth rates. It empowers choice.
Makes sense.
Cultural norms about ideal family size also vary hugely, as does the overall strength and accessibility of the healthcare system influencing maternal and child health.
And death rate variations. Similar story with healthcare.
Largely, yes. The quality and availability of healthcare are paramount. But also things like public sanitation, hygiene practices, the prevalence of malnutrition, and the general standard of living. Nations with robust public health infrastructure and good living conditions simply have lower death rates, generally speaking.
And migration rates. That seems fairly straightforward. Places with more opportunities attract more people. Is it that simple?
That's generally the driving force, yes. Countries with thriving economies, lots of job opportunities, attractive living conditions, maybe political stability, and competitive wages often become magnets for international migrants. Mm. This leads to higher overall population growth rates for them, sometimes masking lower birth rates even. It's kind of a global competition for talent and labor, and population figures often reflect those flows.
It's really giving us a sense of how interconnected all these factors are. It's not just one thing.
Not at all. It's a complex system.
Now, let's zoom out a bit and think about the structure of a population. What exactly does population structure tell us, and why should, say, governments or planners care about it?
Population structure is essentially like taking a detailed census and then organizing everyone by age group and by gender. It gives us a snapshot, a demographic profile of a population at a specific point in time.
Like an age pyramid, basically.
Exactly. The population pyramid is the classic visual representation. And this is incredibly valuable for governments, for economists, for planners, because it helps them understand the relative proportions of different age groups.
Okay, like kids, working age people, elderly people.
Right, children, the working age population, the elderly. This provides... line, and importantly, future needs.
So it's about more than just counting heads. It's understanding the makeup of those heads and what that implies for the future. Planning ahead.
Precisely. Knowing the age distribution allows for proactive planning. For instance, a bulge in the younger age groups, a youth bulge, signals a need for investment in schools, childcare, and eventually job creation down the line.
Yeah, okay.
A large working age population can suggest strong economic potential, the so-called demographic dividend, but only if there are enough jobs.
Right. Potential isn't automatic.
And a growing elderly population, as we see in many countries now, has major implications for pension systems, healthcare infrastructure, social care, housing. It's all about anticipating these future needs rather than just reacting when they hit.
That makes a lot of sense. And this understanding of age distribution leads us, I think you said, directly to the concept of the dependency ratio.
It does, yes.
Dependency ratio, the name itself suggests it's about who relies on whom, economically speaking. Can you break that down?
Absolutely. The dependency ratio is a measure that essentially compares the number of people who are typically considered economically dependent.
Okay, who are they?
That's generally defined as those age 0 to 14, so children, and those age 65 and over, the elderly population.
Right, the pre-workforce and post-workforce groups.
Exactly. It compares them to the number of people who are in the working age population, which is usually defined as individuals between 15 and 64 years old.
So the younger and older segments compared to those in their prime working years, how do we actually calculate it? Is there a formula?
There is, and it's quite straightforward. You take the total number of dependents, so the number of children age 0 to 14, plus the number of elderly age 65 plus blank.
Okay, add those two groups together.
You divide that sum by the total number of people in the working age population, 15 to 64.
Dependents divided by workers.
Right. And then you multiply the result by 100 to express it as a ratio or a percentage, effectively showing how many dependents there are for every 100 working age people.
Okay, so what does a high dependency ratio actually tell us? What are the practical implications?
A high dependency ratio signifies that there's a relatively larger proportion of people who are not in the traditional working age group compared to the number of people who are.
More dependents per worker?
Essentially, yes. This inherently suggests a greater economic burden on that working age population. They're the primary contributors through taxes and their labor, supporting the needs and services required by both the younger and the older generations, schools, healthcare, pensions, social care.
So it can put a real strain on things.
It certainly can. It can strain social security systems, healthcare funding, government budgets, and potentially even overall economic productivity if that burden becomes too large or isn't managed effectively through policy.
That paints a very clear picture of potential economic pressures. Now, shifting gears slightly to a somewhat more maybe abstract idea, the concept of an optimal population. Is there really a perfect number of people for a country or a region?
Well, the idea of an optimal population is quite theoretical, it has to be said. It refers to a population size that is believed to maximize income per capita. So average income per person.
Okay, maximizing individual prosperity, not just total output.
Exactly. And doing so while ensuring the most efficient and crucially sustainable use of all available resources within that area.
Sustainable use, that's key.
Absolutely. It's about finding that theoretical sweet spot, that delicate balance where the population can thrive economically without overstressing the environment or running out of resources, but also without underusing potential.
So it's definitely not just about maximizing the sheer number of people then.
Not at all. In fact, quite the opposite in some ways. If a population grows beyond this theoretical optimal level, we enter the realm of overpopulation.
Which we hear a lot about.
Yes. And that's characterized by having too many people relative to the available resources, things like land, water, energy. This can unfortunately lead to serious problems like widespread poverty, scarcity of essential goods, intense competition, social stress, and increased environmental degradation.
Okay, that's overpopulation. What about the other side?
The other side is underpopulation. This occurs if the population falls significantly below that optimal level.
Too few people.
Essentially, yes. It means there aren't enough people to effectively develop and utilize the available resources. Think of vast territories with very few inhabitants. This can lead to lower productivity, slower economic growth, underutilized infrastructure, and potentially even an inability to defend borders or maintain national cohesion in extreme cases.
So it's a fascinating balancing act, trying to find that theoretical just right level.
Yeah.
Now, let's move from these concepts to the very real tangible effects of population increase. Are there actually any positive outcomes from having more people? We tend to focus on the negatives.
Surprisingly, perhaps, yes, there can be some positive economic effects, particularly up to a certain point, maybe approaching that optimal level we discussed.
Like what?
Well, a larger population can potentially lead to a more efficient utilization of existing resources, simply because there's a larger labor force available to develop, extract, and manage those resources. Think economies of scale.
More hands make lighter work sometimes.
Sometimes. It also naturally creates bigger domestic consumer markets. More people means more demand for goods and services, which can stimulate economic activity, encourage investment, and drive innovation.
Okay, bigger markets, more labor, anything else?
You can also see greater factor mobility. With a larger, more diverse population, labor might move more easily to where it's most needed, geographically or between industries, improving overall economic efficiency.
More flexibility in the workforce.
Potentially,
yeah.
Yes. And just a general increase in the size of the labor force provides a larger pool of talent, diverse skills, potential entrepreneurs, which fuels the potential for overall economic growth and development. More minds working on problems can sometimes lead to faster solutions and advancements.
Okay, so there are some potential upsides, especially from an economic growth perspective. But I imagine the potential downsides of rapid or excessive population increase are often more pressing and certainly more widely discussed.
Indeed. The negative consequences are often more immediately apparent and can pose really significant challenges, especially if growth outpaces the development of infrastructure and resources.
Like the risk of famine.
That's a stark one, yes. There's a very real risk if agricultural production simply cannot keep pace with the growing demand for food. This gets worse if land resources are overused, degraded through unsustainable farming practices, or lost to urbanization. Food security becomes precarious.
And poverty.
Poverty can become more entrenched and widespread. Increased competition for scarce resources, limited job opportunities relative to the number of job seekers, it can all drive down wages and lead to a decline in overall living standards for large segments of the population.
And certainly in many parts of the world, especially in cities, we see the very tangible challenges of overcrowding.
Oh, absolutely. Overcrowding puts immense strain on housing availability, driving up costs. It stresses transportation systems, leading to congestion. It overloads essential infrastructure like water supply, sanitation, waste management.
Leading to public health issues.
Definitely. And it can contribute to social stress, crime, and just a decreased quality of life. Environmentally, the impacts are huge too.
How so?
A larger population generally means greater resource consumption. This can accelerate deforestation for land, timber, and agriculture. It leads to increased levels of pollution, air pollution from traffic and industry, water pollution from sewage and runoff, land pollution from waste. Ecosystems get put under immense pressure.
And jobs. Does more people always mean more unemployment?
Not always, but it's a significant risk. Unemployment can rise sharply if the economy doesn't grow fast enough to create sufficient jobs for the expanding workforce. Too many people chasing too few jobs.
Right.
And one final point, sometimes overlooked, is the potential impact on a country's balance of payments.
How does population affect trade balances?
Well, a rapidly growing population often means a greater demand for all sorts of goods and services. If domestic production can't meet that demand, it necessitates higher levels of imports, which can lead to trade deficits and put pressure on the national currency.
Wow, those are some really significant, wide-ranging challenges that come with rapid population growth. So given these potential downsides, what tools do societies actually have? What are some of the population control or management measures that can be implemented?
There are various strategies operating at different levels that have been and continue to be employed, often with varying degrees of success and ethical debate, it should be said.
Okay.
One approach is to manage the inflow controlling immigration. This could be done through stricter immigration laws, setting quotas, or implementing points-based systems to regulate the number and type of people entering a country.
Right, controlling the borders. But what about managing the growth from within, influencing birth rates?
Yes, that's often where the more direct population policies focus. Education and public awareness campaigns play a really vital role here.
How does education help?
Well, educating people, especially women and girls, about the benefits of smaller family sizes, both for the family itself and for society, can be very effective. Raising awareness about family planning methods is also key.
So providing information.
Information and access. ensuring widespread, affordable, and culturally acceptable access to family planning services and various methods of contraception is absolutely crucial. It empowers individuals to make informed choices about if and when to have children.
Access is critical then.
Definitely. And somewhat counterintuitively, investing in and improving overall health care and nutrition, especially for mothers and children, can also contribute to lower birth rates over time.
How does better health care lead to fewer births? That seems odd.
It's because it significantly reduces child mortality. When parents have greater confidence that their existing children will survive and thrive into adulthood, they may feel less need to have many children to ensure some survive. It changes the calculus.
Ah, I see. The insurance factor diminishes.
Exactly. And then, of course, governments can take more direct policy actions.
Like what? Financial incentives?
That's one approach. Things like tax benefits for smaller families or, more controversially, penalties for larger ones. Though these can be ethically complex and hard to implement fairly.
I can imagine. What else?
Other policies might include increasing the mandatory age for schooling or even the legal age for marriage. Delaying marriage and keeping young people, especially girls, in education longer tends to delay childbearing and often leads to smaller families overall.
So a combination of information, access, healthcare improvements, and sometimes direct policies.
It's usually a multi-pronged approach, yes.
Now let's turn our attention to a demographic trend that's really prominent now in many developed countries and increasingly elsewhere too, aging populations. What exactly defines an aging population and what's driving this shift?
An aging population is essentially characterized by a growing proportion, a larger percentage, of older individuals within the overall population mix. Usually we mean people aged 65 and over.
So the population pyramid starts looking more like a column or even top-heavy.
Exactly. Less like a pyramid, more rectangular, or even inverted in extreme cases.
Yeah.
And this demographic shift is primarily driven by two key factors working together, which are, firstly, persistently low birth rates.
Yeah.
Fewer young people are being born, so the younger cohorts are smaller relative to the older ones.
Right. Fewer kids coming in at the bottom.
And secondly, increased life expectancy. People are simply living longer lives thanks to those advancements in healthcare, nutrition, and living standards we talked about earlier.
So fewer births plus longer lives equals an older population structure.
That's the basic equation, yes.
And what are the major societal and economic consequences when a country has a significantly larger proportion of elderly citizens?
There are several really significant impacts that ripple through society. One of the most immediate and widely discussed is a higher dependency ratio.
Back to that again, more older dependents this time.
Exactly. More retirees relative to the number of working age individuals who need to support them through pension systems, taxes for health care, social security contributions, and so on. This can put considerable financial strain on both the working population and government budgets.
The fiscal pressure. What else?
Secondly, an aging population often leads to a shrinking labor force, or at least slower growth in the workforce. This can potentially dampen overall economic productivity, innovation, and growth, if not counteracted.
Fewer workers, potentially slower economy.
We also see a predictable and often steep increase in the demand for healthcare services. Older individuals generally have more complex and chronic health needs, requiring more doctor visits, hospital stays, long-term care, placing a much greater burden on healthcare systems and budgets.
Huge costs associated with that.
Definitely. Furthermore, there's a growing need for robust pension systems and other welfare provisions to support a larger elderly population, many of whom may be living for decades post-retirement.
A pension funding challenge.
And finally, the overall patterns of demand within the economy can shift quite dramatically. You might see increased demand for things like healthcare, pharmaceuticals, assisted living facilities, accessible transport, leisure activities for seniors. While there might be a relative decrease in demand for goods and services typically consumed by younger demographics, like perhaps schools or certain types of consumer goods, businesses need to adapt.
So societies facing this major demographic shift really need to adapt in significant ways. It sounds quite challenging. What are some of the strategies countries are exploring or implementing to cope?
There are several coping strategies being discussed and implemented, often in combination. One common approach, though often politically difficult, is to gradually increase the statutory retirement age.
Keep people working longer.
Essentially, yes. Encouraging people to remain in the workforce for longer periods helps to increase the size of the contributing working age population and delays the onset of pension payouts, easing the dependency ratio slightly.
Makes sense if people are healthier for longer. What else?
Investing in re-education and retraining programs can be important. These can help older workers acquire new skills, adapt to changing job market demands, and remain economically active, maybe shifting to less physically demanding roles. Lifelong learning becomes key.
Adapting the existing workforce.
Another strategy is encouraging immigration, specifically targeting younger, skilled workers. This can help to offset the decline in the domestic labor force, inject vitality into the economy, and improve the dependency ratio by adding more contributors.
Bringing in younger workers from elsewhere.
Yes. And finally, some countries are exploring pronatalist policies, incentives aimed at encouraging higher birth rates.
Trying to boost the number of babies.
Exactly. This might involve financial support like generous child benefits or parental leave, subsidized childcare, tax breaks for families, essentially trying to make it easier and more attractive for people to have more children. The goal is to rejuvenate the younger segments of the population over the long term, although the effectiveness and cost of these measures can vary greatly, and the impact takes decades to be felt.
Right, that's a very long-term strategy. Okay, let's move on to one last major topic. Internal migration. We talked about international migration, but what about movement within a country?
Yes, internal migration is simply the movement of people from one defined region, like a state or province or county, to another within the geographical boundaries of the same nation. No border crossing involved.
And what's the most common type?
Globally, the most prevalent type by far is the movement from rural areas to urban centers, from the countryside to the cities.
The rural-urban shift, what drives that?
It's primarily motivated by perceived opportunities. The prospect of better paying or more diverse job opportunities is a huge pull factor. Greater access to higher education institutions, universities, colleges is another. And often, there's a perception of higher overall living standards, better amenities, healthcare, entertainment, you name it, available in urban environments.
So it's a major force behind that ongoing trend of urbanization we see absolutely everywhere.
Absolutely. Internal migration, specifically this rural to urban flow, is a fundamental driver of urbanization worldwide. It leads to the rapid growth of cities and the gradual transformation of societies from being predominantly rural to increasingly urbanized.
And what are the effects of this massive internal movement on the places people leave, the rural areas, and the places they move to, the cities?
The effects are definitely felt in both the originating rural areas and the destination urban areas.
Let's start with the rural areas people leave behind.
Okay. In rural areas experiencing significant outmigration, we often see a decline in the size and sometimes the vitality of the local workforce. This can negatively impact key sectors like agriculture, which might struggle for labor, and the broader rural economy can shrink.
Fewer workers, less economic activity.
It can also lead to an increase in the rural dependency ratio, oddly enough, because it's often the younger, working-age individuals who migrate.
Leaving behind the kids and the elderly.
Exactly. So you end up with a higher portion of dependents relative to working age adults in those areas. We can also sometimes observe a gender imbalance, as men might initially migrate to cities seeking work in greater numbers than women in some contexts.
Interesting.
Furthermore, there's often a brain drain phenomenon. Educated and skilled individuals leave rural areas for better opportunities in cities, leading to a shortage of expertise. Doctors, teachers, technicians in the countryside.
That sounds challenging for rural development. Is there any upside for the rural areas?
Well, one significant positive impact can be remittances. The money sent back by urban migrants to their families still living in rural areas can become a vital source of income, boosting local consumption and improving living standards for those families. It creates an important economic link.
Okay, so remittances help. What about the impact on the cities they move to?
In the receiving urban areas, rapid population growth due to internal migration can bring both dynamism and significant challenges. On the plus side, it provides labor for growing industries and services. But it can also lead to overcrowding, strain on housing supply leading to slums or informal settlements, pressure on infrastructure like transport, water, sanitation, and increased demand for social services like schools and healthcare. Managing rapid urbanization is a huge task for city planners.
It really is fascinating, isn't it? Seeing how all these different dynamics, birth rates, death rates, international migration, internal migration, are constantly interacting and reshaping our world in such profound ways.
Indeed. the size, the structure, the distribution, the movement of populations. Yeah. These are not just abstract statistics on a page. Mm. They have very real, very direct, and often very far-reaching consequences for individuals, for communities, for economies, and ultimately for the entire planet.
Yeah.
Understanding these complex dynamics, I think, is absolutely crucial if we want to effectively address the challenges and maybe even seize the opportunities that the future holds.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive into the world of population, it's really clear, isn't it? We've explored this deeply interconnected web of factors, you know, from the basics of births and deaths to the complex patterns of migration, both across borders and within them. And looking at those long-term consequences of aging, it all really plays a huge role in shaping our societies.
It truly does. Everything's connected.
Thinking about all these interconnected elements we've discussed today, if you had to pick one, what single factor do you believe might exert the most significant influence on global population trends in the, say, next few decades? And why would that be? That's definitely something for all of us to really ponder. Thank you for joining us on The Deep Dive.